providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In the final few segments of this weekend show, we're going to focus a bit more on some individual, more commodities sectors. Starting off now with Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Prospectus Group. Now, we have had Dan on the show a fair bit over the last few months to focus on the energy sector. Dan is an independent analyst that does a lot of good work when it comes to diving into the fundamentals of the sector, as well as the companies, both large and small. Dan has a number of different portfolios that he outlines to his subscribers that take us through dividend paying stocks the whole way down to some of the smaller energy stocks. Before we get into the stocks, though, Dan, let's talk about broadly the energy sector. We have seen a fairly substantial pullback in energy prices. You look at something like the crude price, and as we're recording this, the crude futures contract is down in the $82 a barrel region, long way off of those triple digit numbers that we had. And it was, again, a fairly quick fall down to these levels. Dan, let's start with this general pullback in oil prices. What in your eyes is causing this? And do you think this is a general change in trend here where we could continue to see generally lower prices?
Well, first of all, we have a global energy crisis, and it's going to get extremely intense this winter, especially in Europe. All home heating fuels, oil, even coal, propane, natural gas, those inventories are extremely low. And Europe does really, if they have a colder than normal winter, it's going to get desperate over there. They're going to be burning a lot of firewood, I can tell you that. But the only fundamental thing that I see that justifies the recent pullback in oil price is that the U.S. dollar has gained about 15%, primarily because the euro is tanking. So the U.S. dollar, it, compared to other currencies, that's how they come up with the index. I think the symbol is DXY, but if you just, you know, Google U.S. dollar index, you can find it, but you'll see the chart. And this is the highest valuation of the U.S. dollar in many years, maybe 20 or 30 years, compared to all these other currencies. And oil around the world trades primarily in U.S. dollars. And so when the dollar goes up, so it's gone up about 15%, and the oil price has pulled back about 15%. So if you say we were back at the right price for oil was $100 a barrel at the beginning of the year, so take that 15% off and you'd be about 85, which is about just above where we are today. Now, the other thing that spooked the market is Europe is trying to put price caps on Russian crude oil, and Vladimir Putin is saying, nit, 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 I'm not doing it. And so he has informed them that he's going to cut off all oil and gas exports to Europe. And they rely heavily, especially the Eastern European countries like Poland, Germany. Their economies are in really big trouble, and they've already had to shut down a lot of industrial users that cannot afford that higher cost energy over there, because their gas price is like 10 or 15 times higher than our gas price, which is impacting their electricity prices. But the other thing is, you know, there's still COVID lockdowns in China, and that just doesn't seem to be getting resolved anytime soon. And so that's got some impact on demand. Although I did see the actual report that their July oil imports were higher than the month before. And then you got OPEC in their last meeting earlier this week, they announced a production cut. And basically I see that as a bullish indication, because it indicates to me that they will do what is necessary to shore up the oil price. Several of the OPEC countries actually need $100 oil to balance their financial budgets, to support their massive, social programs, especially in Saudi Arabia. So they've got control, because there's nowhere else that anybody's holding back oil production. And as a result, they can control the oil price to a big extent. Anyway, so that's why I see it right now, but I don't see any quick solution to what's just ahead of us, which is a very tight energy market heading into the winter.
Well, Dan, I think you set the table well there as far as the situation in Europe. really exasperated by some of these price controls they put on Russia. Also them temporarily working on Nord Stream 1 only to then shut it down for longer, which everybody kind of expected that would be the case. But we also have this other situation where the United States is shipping liquid natural gas over to Europe now. And again, there's a lot higher prices there. So we're kind of unloading some of our nat gas into Europe. I don't blame companies for wanting to do that, but we're kind of reducing the supply we have domestically. Not to mention, we are also continually in the U.S. releasing our strategic reserves to a degree we've not seen in a long time. So I guess from a supply-demand fundamental side, how long can all that go on before we need to tap the brakes here and keep a little bit more home domestically?
Well, on natural gas, we're going to be fine. We're going to probably start the winter with around 300 billion cubic feet below where we should be. I mean, we have a massive storage system in the United States because we burn so much more natural gas in the wintertime than we do in the summertime. So refilling storage every year during the summer is not optional. It has to be done for us to make it through the next cold winter. So normally we have something like 3.8 TCF or 3,800 BCF of gas in storage. And it looks like we're going to start the winter with around 3,400 or 3,500. So we're going to be at least 300 BCF below the five-year average and even way below last year's beginning inventory amount. And last year, you remember the winter started out pretty mild last year, but then it was a La Nina winter. They start mild and then they get real severe in the first quarter of the year. And if we have a repeat of last year's winter, we will drain storage down by the end of the winter, way below where it's been in a long time. And as a result, that should keep gas prices high all of next year as a result, because we're looking at today around $8 gas, a little bit less maybe, but it was up over $9. It actually briefly touched $10. Plus, from a percentage standpoint, the moves in natural gas can be even bigger than the moves in the oil price, but we're still way above where we were a year ago. A year ago, we were below $5. We were at, you know, $4.85 or something 1 year ago exactly today. So the gas producers are really in good shape. Their balance sheets are in incredibly good shape. Nobody's got any debt problems at this point.
Let's talk about some of the companies then, Dan, because look, it is a generally lower price environment. The oil companies were really making a lot of money when oil was over $100, let alone when it touched almost $125. Natural gas, that was the whole way up to almost $10, down to just under $8, let's say. So a lower general price for what these companies are pulling out of the ground. How are they still health-wise and in terms of current cash flow-wise?
All of our upstream companies that are primarily gas producers, I call them the gassers, they lead our model portfolios. Antero is up like 140%. Comstock up 120-some%. EQT, which is the largest gas producer in the U.S., which just announced a big multi-billion-dollar merger this week, and it's going to make them even bigger. and they are getting out from under a lot of. They made a lot of money this year despite having some really terrible hedges. I think their actual realized price is something like $4.50 or something for gas when gas in the market is like $8 because they hedged it, a bunch of it at really low prices. So they're going to actually, even if the price would say pull back to like $7 or something during the winter, they would actually have higher realized cash prices because they can, in the first quarter, they'll be selling a lot more unhedged gas. But yeah, these guys look good. And I, right now, if you want the safest bets that I like, I would go after some of these companies in our high yield income portfolio that are paying like 11, 12% dividend. They have fixed plus variable dividends, but they're all generating so much cash flow. Free cash flow, they're distributing like 50 or 60% of their cash flow is being distributed out as dividends. And then they're also have real aggressive stock buyback programs. So they're reducing the number of their outstanding shares, which makes the per share valuation higher. They've paid off all of their near-term debt problems. Some of them could be completely debt-free if they just pushed all their free cash flow to debt payments. But Coterra, it really looks good to me. And it is, It is a new company market, but it was created by the merger of two older companies. Cimarex Energy merged into Cabot Oil and Gas, and then they immediately changed the name of the company to Coterra. And that symbol is CTRA. And it's based on my forecast, their dividend this yield should be about 10.5%. So real nice dividends coming in, even if the stock prices don't do that much. Three other ones that I have in there that are big upstream companies that pay big dividends: Devon Energy, DVN, Diamondback Energy, FANG, and Pioneer Natural Resources, the largest of them all, PXD. And combined, they're all paying 8% to 11% dividend yield right now.
Well, Dan, that brings up an interesting question, because there's no doubt that the free cash flows that the oil and gas companies have been pulling in have been used to pay down their debt, to return equity to shareholders by buying back their shares or doing dividends or even special dividends. But there isn't as much news, or isn't as much discussion about companies reinvesting into growth. Do you see any companies that are actually taking some of that free cash flow and investing in their future by investing in growth?
Yeah, I think they're getting some pressure to do it. You know, they were under all this pressure to pay out dividends. Well, now you got the other side. The same hedge funds are telling them, well, let's drill, baby, drill. Let's, you know, get anyway, it's typical Wall Street stuff, right? Because Diamondback had been saying, Diamondback, which is FANG, F-A-N-G, they were saying a couple months ago that they were just going to hold production flat, you know. Now, the other day they came out, they said they're going to increase their drilling program to get 3 to 5% production growth next year, and they can fund it all and totally 100% with operating cash flow. Yeah, most of them, I want to see a combination of growth plus income, but no longer this, you know, drill, baby, drill. Every dollar we make goes right back into the ground. We don't want that. And I will tell you, they had to do that in the early days of the shale plays. Remember, they were acquiring these huge acreage positions, and they have to drill those leases in order to hold those leases. Otherwise, they lose them. And so they had a lot of what I would call lease pressure, you know, land department pressure. Hey, guys, we got to drill these leases, or once we paid, you know, thousands of dollars per acre for these leases, so we got to drill them or we're going to lose them. So they had to do that. Well, now they've drilled up their best acreage and they hold that acreage, but they still have, you know, one 2-mile long horizontal well can hold like 1,200 acres. 1280, you know, each section 640, it can hold two sections. So 1280, but then they hold all that acreage with one well, but there may be room for, you know, 20 wells on that property in different zones, you know, vertically and horizontally. They can put a lot more wells in. So, and it's also that oil field services was so hurt by the pandemic. They lost a lot of people, you know, they had to scrap a bunch of equipment. And the one complaint that I'm hearing from some of the companies is there just isn't any quality rigs left out there. They're all working. And, you know, you can't just bring some old, you know, rusty rig out there to drill well when you're drilling a 2-mile long lateral. These are really high tech rigs, and the good ones are all done. I tell you, I haven't looked at any recently, but I bet you the drilling companies like Helmerich and Payne and Patterson, I bet they really look good now, because all their big high dollar rigs are going out and they're able to raise their rig rates. Now there is some cost inflation, definitely cost inflation for both the drilling rigs and for tubulars in the field too. So I've seen about a 15 or 20% increase in well costs on some of these companies.
Yeah, we've seen costs for all companies rising. But one other point, look, you made the point that companies have paid down a lot of their debt, if not all of their debt. However, these companies do depend a fair bit on debt if they are going to go down that growth avenue. And we all know that interest rates have gone up. How much will higher cost of borrowing impact some of the growth plans for some of these companies?
Well, for one thing, because their balance sheets are in so much better shape than they used to be, and their year-end reserve reports are going to support a higher debt level, they should be able to borrow money at a lower interest rate compared to where they were when everybody thought the whole, you know, we wouldn't even need oil in 5 years. So that should help them. But all of the ones that I'm following, one of my criteria for valuing these companies is I will not recommend a company that isn't free cash flow positive. So they can fund quite a bit of additional drilling if they want to, just with their own cash flow. So they don't need to go out and borrow. And they're starting to have more chance to go back to the equity market if they had to raise equity too. But right now, a lot of these larger companies that I follow, they don't need any more money. And they could significantly increase their drilling programs anyway.
Well, Dan, I would love you just to quickly unpack how you value these companies, you know, with your models, just a rough overview, because the way it reads in looking at some of the pieces you've written to subscribers is you still think there's a lot of upside in these companies, even if oil was to stay where it is now or if nat gas was to pull back. So how do you value these or what is important to you as a criteria?
Well, the criteria is we've talked about one, strong balance sheet. So I want to make sure they have no near-term debt problems, because I tell you, if there's a pullback in price, the first guys that are going to come after you are the debt holders. And you don't want to get in trouble that you can't pay your vendors and stuff like that. So I want to make sure they have plenty of liquidity and strong cash flow. Then I look at production growth is a big deal. That's part of it. And I want them to have what I call a lot of running room. I want to own companies that have in their inventories a lot of acreage that they can drill, where, you know, some of these companies have thousands. One of the biggest companies I follow is EOG Resources, has about a $70 billion market cap. They literally have like 6,000 or 7,000 what they call premium well locations, or double premium. And at $80 oil, those locations would pay out in less than a year, and they would have a 3 or 4 return on their money invested in those properties. So they have got massive running room. And that's a big deal in my valuation, because see, I worked for Hess for 18 years. In the last few years, I was part of a business development group, and we were looking for takeover targets. And our first screen was, could we buy a company for 6x cash flow? Well, right now I look at our Sweet 16 growth portfolio. This is our flagship model portfolio. These are companies I've followed for 5, 6, 10 years, all of them. And the average company is trading for like 2.5x cash flow. When I was at Hess, we would be out making offers trying to buy these companies like crazy if we could, because they're high quality companies with a lot of running room. So if you can find a company that you could buy for, let's say, 3x cash flow, and this company had a whole bunch of drilling inventory, you're basically getting that drilling inventory for free. So that's the way we looked at it. Instead of going out and leasing raw land and having to go out and do seismic and, you know, drill exploration wells and everything, you can buy these companies today that have a tremendous amount of low risk, high return drilling inventory just sitting on their books. So I really can't believe there hasn't been more merger activity. Now, I mentioned a few of these like Coterra, where companies have merged together to, you know, save money on the synergies of being a bigger company, and also, you know, get more attention from the Wall Street gang by being bigger. And I think we'll see some of that. So there's some stuff left to come. But I really do think we will see commodity price, especially oil and natural gas, ramp up again as we get closer to winter, because these space heating fuel inventories are just dangerously low.
So Dan, why are companies so much more undervalued than they were many years ago, especially with the run higher in energy? Are there just less investors caring or watching these energy companies? Or is there a bigger picture theme here that maybe we need to understand the companies won't go back to some of these historic valuations?
Well, the ESG crowd, that's put some pressure. There's a lot of funds that cannot invest in fossil fuel businesses anymore. So that's off the table. Then you've also got the millennials, Gen Z people that believe we're all going to be driving Teslas in 3 or 4 years and that we won't need oil anymore. There is no way we're going to get off of oil. And I will tell you one thing, what's happening in Europe, and it's going to get bad, really bad in Europe this winter. There's not going to be anybody showing up at that next Paris Climate Accord meeting. And I could guarantee you that China and India are not coming to any more of those meetings. They're done with that crap. And they are half the world's population, and their population wants energy. They want high standards of living like we have. And they're going to be burning coal. They're going to be burning oil and gas. And India and China are buying every barrel they can of Russian oil, and they're happy to take it at cheaper prices. So This is an energy-starved world, and there I see nothing that is going to get us off fossil fuels. People just cannot understand the immense amount of energy, the energy density of oil, all of them, coal, oil, and natural gas have incredible energy density, and there's nothing that can reach that scale that I see. And it, and even if we are driving a lot of electric cars, you got to generate the electricity by burning something.
That's a good point, Dan. A lot of the nat gas goes to nat gas power plants. And if people want to get off coal, nat gas is the natural transition. And there's even some plants that are hybrid that do both and can go back and forth based on pricing. I guess just as we wrap up, is there one sector within our subsector within the energy space you like the most? So be it a jurisdiction or offshore versus onshore, or is there a certain well field that you really like more than others? Anything that really catches your eye at this point?
Well, I do think the natural gas companies are the safest bet in the near term. I think the next two or three quarters, as we go through into the winter months, they should draw a lot more attention. Then they are going to report some stunning numbers in the third and fourth and first quarter. For the next three quarters, the reports are going to be very, very strong. And they've already, you know, shored up their balance sheet, paid off a lot of debt. By the time we get to the end of March, these companies are going to be pristine balance sheets, and they're going to be paying big dividends. I would go look there. I think the midstream companies still look good. I still have three in our high yield income portfolio. One Oak is very safe, not that great of a dividend, about 6%, but really good. Plains All American Pipeline. Now, this one looks good because they have a lot of the pipe coming out of the Permian Basin, and that's going to be the biggest growth area in the United States. I think half the rigs that are running in the United States are drilling in West Texas's Permian Basin, and that production has to be put into pipelines to get to the refiners and to the coast for export. So they're going to be getting a lot of tolls, I call it. So they look good. And I like the minerals companies too. They're safe. They have very low overhead. We follow five of them. Two of them are merging, a big merger, an all-stock merger. Cytos, I call it. I probably mispronounced it. Its symbol is STR, is merging with Brigham, MNRL. And my valuation of MNRL is about 50% higher than where it's trading today. So that's one to check out.
All right, Dan, we'll wrap it up here. It's always interesting hearing your thoughts on the energy sector, as well as driving down into the companies that, again, you follow through your service. If anybody wants more information on Dan and the Energy Perspectives Group, feel free to email us. And we're going to keep on having Dan back on the show because he really is one of our go-to energy analysts, especially driving down into the company. Dan, thanks for joining us on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
All right. Thanks a lot.